being a special constable, you get to go and fit door locks on all people's homes. But it's not just that. It's like that old person might not see anybody for months, and then it takes you an hour to fit a door lock. But that old person has then been so, I don't know, comforted by your presence, and having a uniform on the doorstep, and then sitting down having a cup of tea. But thinking back, a regular constable in those days wouldn't have had the time to do that, whereas we as volunteers could actually give so much more back. And I know it sounds daft, like, oh, you only fitted a door lock. We didn't. We spent an hour with that old person.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to episode 37 of the Building Better Leaders podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. We've been getting some really lovely feedback and a few great shares on LinkedIn and social media, so thank you so much for that. And somebody did email in a couple of weeks ago and asked for us to do a podcast on advice around what to do if you're in a job that you're not enjoying, but you don't want to start looking for a new job because you don't know what it is you want to do. So when I was thinking about what we might talk about to help this individual solve this issue, the concept of ikigai came to mind. For those of you that haven't heard of ikigai, it is a Japanese concept. It's associated with the search for what's important and the belief that if you discover your ikigai, you will have more satisfaction and meaning in life. Now, I was thinking about how we might structure this in a conversation, and I actually thought the best way to do this is to invite somebody on the podcast who I think, from having coached them, so I have invited an ex-client onto the podcast to speak today, is for me, this person lives their ikigai every single day. He's an incredibly positive chap. He has a wonderful energy about him. He does incredibly purposeful work. He's an incredibly passionate human being. He has come into leadership later in life. He has found his leadership journey through following his ikigai and his passion. And he's also works for an organisation that really understands this concept of if you give people autonomy to do what they love, that they will work harder for you and you will have a really successful business as a result. The person that I'm talking about is Adrian Hawley, who is head of corporate protection at Partners in Cost. But for the person who came up with this request, what I hope that you will take from Adrian's journey is that a career path and a leadership journey does not need to be linear. He's done numerous jobs. He's kind of, in his own words, stumbled across work that he's found a lot of purpose in today. But all the way through, he's just stayed curious and he's had this love for learning that has led him to really great things. I hope you take a lot out of this conversation. It's a different approach to a leadership journey than what we'd usually take, but I think it's all the more valuable as a result. Enjoy. Adrian, welcome to the podcast. It is wonderful to see your lovely face today. Would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners and talk a little bit about what you do at Partners in Cost and what does a head of corporate protection do?
Hello, Rachel and everybody else. It's, I don't know, quite bizarre. I think I have quite a unique job. Partners in Costs has existed since 1996 and provides costing services to solicitors. In the main, it's clinical negligence, personal injury and corporate protection work that we undertake. And we take solicitors' papers and in simple terms, turn those into a bill of costs that's then argued the other side, and the solicitor eventually gets paid the costs. Now, it sounds quite simplistic, but it's actually quite in depth, and there's a whole separate court structure when it comes to solicitors' costs. When it comes to being head of court protection, I head up a team of staff who draft the bills that are then sort of taken on board to police the actions of a solicitor every 12 months in a case where the Court of Protection has appointed a solicitor deputy to act on someone's behalf who lacks mental capacity. And I don't know, I got into that particular field through a previous job and then concentrated on it in this particular job for the last, I think, 6 years. And I don't know, it's just opened up so many different doors and avenues to a whole new way of, I think, looking at the way the courts work and operate and how solicitors work. I'll give an example where a solicitor does get appointed after the Court of Protection has said that that person lacks mental capacity. Now, it could be that they were born, starved of oxygen at birth, or alternative, they've been involved in an accident that's changed their life dramatically. And the solicitor's then there to handle a sum of money for the person's, well, for the rest of the person's life. So it's quite in depth of what the Court of Protection can do.
Right. So it's, so in a way, I mean, it sounds like quite rewarding work, but I imagine some of the cases are really hard to read and to kind of think of at an emotional level as well.
They are. You certainly have to learn to cut off from the emotions of the case just to present the facts. And why do we present the facts? Well, as I said, every 12 months, those solicitors' costs have to be assessed by the senior court, which in turn, the solicitor is also policed by the Office of the Public Guardian. So some of the cases which involve the mental capacity of a young child, you sometimes think is more horrific. But then when you see the life-changing consequences of somebody having an accident who maybe, for example, be 40 years old, having two young kids, the impact upon a family is quite, well, it's so traumatic. And that even comes across in the paperwork that you read.
Can imagine. So you've been doing this for 6 years. You're very well known on the legal circuits in this case. And when you and I met, I was coaching you on what was going to be next in your career. And why I've invited you on the podcast and what we're going to talk to today is your job is only one place where you demonstrate leadership. And we're really going to explore this kind of concept of finding more meaning and purpose in work and in leadership and in life. And you know, you do work that's very purposeful, as you've just explained. But what I really find fascinating about you is you kind of find meaning and purpose, and you demonstrate leadership in lots of different areas of your life. And really your work's been the way that's brought you into these kind of avenues. So your work with Court of Protection has led you to do a lot of work with Headway. Do you want to talk around that and your leadership role within the Headway charity?
Yeah, it's I don't know how I seem to fall into these things. It's, maybe falling is the wrong word, but I get involved. And I think initially reading different files and you see the charities that support people following a brain injury. For example, there's Headway, the Brain Injury Association.
Yeah.
Then there's CBIT, the Children's Brain Injury Trust. There are other charities as well that are more specialised, but it tends to be that CBIT deals with the youngsters up to 18 and then gets passed across to Headway. Headway exists, gosh, in two separate functions, really. There's the national sort of campaigning that they do, which at the moment they've taken on board the mantle of looking at Alzheimer's for footballers who've headed footballs, to campaigns to encourage children to wear bicycle helmets. And then on the grassroots level with Headway, they have groups and branches across the country. A group is set up as a charity in its own right under the Headway umbrella, and a branch is part of the national structure and tend to be smaller. And they're there to look after people on a day-to-day basis in their lives in terms of organising. Well, for example, assistance with food shopping or the carers of the family getting together to talk about their particular problems, say, with welfare benefits. And again, when you look at the people involved in Headway, yes, solicitors get involved. And I think it's more for the fact that for their, I don't know, paying back to the society in which they work, supporting people in a claim for damages with a brain injury, to then giving people something back to support them in these groups and branches. For me in particular, I got involved after speaking at a conference in Manchester about 6 years ago, where I was talking about the charities that we support at Partners in Costs, which also includes, say, Spinal Injuries Association. Again, a lot of our solicitor clients deal with spinal injury cases. And it led me to gosh, I think that the first thing I did was a triathlon over 31 days to raise money for Backup Trust. That's another spinal charity.
Yeah.
And I was talking about my charity work to this audience of other charity workers, regional coordinators and directors of charities, and saying, why does the average person get involved who doesn't have a link in any reason to these charities? You know, it might be that you support a cancer charity because your mother's had cancer. Yeah. And they were more asking me questions as to why you are involved, and but you don't really have a link. I said, well, it's just to give something back to society is the first thing. And then at coffee break, a lady came up to me from Headway, who was the regional coordinator, and says, Adrian, why have you never done anything for Headway? I said, well, no one's ever asked me. She said, well, I'm asking you now. I wonder if you could help. I said, well, tell me more about Headway. So we had a long chat, and then we met the week later, and she says, Do you live in Doncaster? I said, no, that's where my head office is, but I actually live in Huddersfield. And she says, oh, marvellous. She says, I have a small branch there where they seem to be dwindling and there's no one to hold them together. And I wonder if you could kind of get involved with a committee to see if there's anything you can do. And that was 4 years ago.
And now what's your leadership role with Headway?
Well, I'm chair of my local branch. We've doubled our membership in 4 years and found, and let me tell you, it's difficult to find people with brain injuries purely using social media to try and attract people to join in. Mm. We had a campaign where we contacted every general practitioner's practice manager in the whole of Calderdale and Kirklees. That's the two council areas in which we cover. And then we are now, well, COVID got in the way. We started the process of becoming a group in our own right. And it took some persuading to some of our older committee members whose children have brain injuries. And there, I think it was more of a social gathering to share experiences that they were undertaking. But then when they saw what we could actually do as a group, and it's little things like we can actually claim gift aid on donations we receive.
Yeah.
Whereas being part of the national structure, if you give some money to Headway UK, they claim gift aid. But because we're a branch of that charity, there's so many different rules and regulations that apply, and that's one thing I'd like to sort out in later life, but I haven't got time right now, is the way that you can give to a branch of a large charity. So it's also things such as obtaining free software from different organisations and seeking different grants from local authorities. There's so much more we can do. And then at that point, when we become a charity in our own right, we'd like to employ a link worker or someone of a similar sounding name, where we could have somebody working 20 hours a week that does the legwork to try and find more people with brain injuries who live in our community who need help and support. Or when somebody first has a brain injury, there is the first point of contact to tell them how they can be supported and what benefits are available. There's just so much more we can do, Rachel.
Yeah, I love this. And why we invited you on the podcast is to really talk around you. A lot of the guests we have on this podcast are either senior leaders or they're leading big teams. And we talk about leadership in the context of large organisation and leading lots of teams. But what I'm really struck by with you is you kind of seek out leadership roles, but you create your own in the community, and you're, you know, with no link to anybody with a brain trauma or brain damage, is you've kind of got this job where you are head of Court of Protection, but you felt like you wanted to give back within that. And so you've taken on this role and created a leadership role that you do on a volunteer basis in the community to bring people together. What is it that you get out of this, and what is it that you drives you to pursue this kind of path in life?
That's a very hard question, Rachel. And to be honest, I'm still trying to find the answer to that question. But I think, I don't know, when I look back, let's take open water swimming, for example. Mm. My open water swimming actually led me to actually swim the channel for Headway. Well, just before I talk about that, it was somebody in the office when we were in Manchester who said, oh, there's this open water swim at Salford Quays, and it's to raise money for a spinal injury charity. So I signed up for that. Never done open water swimming in my life. And that must have been 7 years ago. And I was immediately hooked. Very fortunate for me, just up the road where I live in Huddersfield, there's a Canals and Rivers Trust reservoir where swimming is permitted. Well, okay. It was permitted years ago. And then I think it was 12 years ago, the no swimming signs went up. Right. And then I don't know why, but I became involved in a campaign to reinstate swimming in this particular reservoir. And a team of us open water swimmers got together and we found documentation and we interviewed people who got their bronze open water swimming medal in 1953 and got a certificate from the school because the schools used to take them to this particular reservoir.
Yeah.
And all the reservoir is used to top up the canal. So it's not like has flowing water or drinking water. It's just purely to top up the canal and the water comes off the hills. And eventually, after much campaigning and badgering local councillors and then sitting down for a roundtable meeting with the Canals and Rivers Trust, we managed to get swimming permitted in this reservoir at your own risk. And a council fund actually paid for some signs, some safety signs to be put up. And that became my training ground to open water swimming. And from there, I did various different competitions across the country and encompass the love of open water swimming, so much so that when Headway UK were looking for people to do different charity fundraising events, I joined a small local swimming club in Bradford. It was recommended to me by an open water swimmer, saying this fabulous open water swimmer, she swum the channel herself and she set up a small swimming school. Would you be interested in going to help support her? I said yes, went along. And would you believe within 6 months, we'd agreed with the three people out of my swimming lane to form a relay team to swim the channel.
Amazing.
And again, that opened up a whole new kettle of fish, as in what do you do to swim the channel? You know, you contact the Channel Pilots Swimming Association and the Pilots Federation, and then you bid for a boat for a particular time. And then you have a 7-day period in which you can swim. But the pilot will take on 5 other individuals or teams in that time period. And you are very much at the look of the draw of the tides and the winds and the pressure systems that pass over the channel. They're just unbelievable. The cost is not cheap. It's about £4,000 to £5,000 in total when you pay for the hire of the boat, for your accommodation, for getting to and from the seaside to go and swim in the sea. There's a whole host of things behind the scenes. That then led to agreeing to raise the funds for Headway UK. We got the call saying, yes, your swim's on. And we were booked for June 2018. And we hired a small little chalet just outside Dover to be our base for the week. And then on day 3, we got the call saying, you're swimming tomorrow morning. Can you be here in the harbour for 4 a.m.? So 5 of us, because we included our, shall we say, not a swim coach, but he was more of a support for the boat to help, bizarrely, end up drying us, feeding us pot noodles. Because you cannot believe how tired you are after 1 hour of swimming. So this relay, sorry, let me go back. The relay is, there was 4 of us, and you swim for an hour, and then person number 2 gets in, so an hour 5, you're back in the water again.
Right, okay, yeah.
The channel is 21 miles across, door to door. However, the tidal system takes you on an S shape across from coast to coast. And you can actually swim around about 32 miles in total to get from shore to shore.
Right.
So there we were, halfway through, we'd passed into the mid-channel. And all the time I'm posting on Facebook and Twitter going, we need some more sponsorship. You know, it's really difficult and the water's freezing. It's 9 degrees Celsius and there's jellyfish and there's things floating in the sea you wouldn't imagine. But then it's the shock of a massive container ship coming up the channel, radioing the pilot saying, you know, we need to make way and what's your path? And they said, well, currently we've got a young lady in the water who's swimming for charity and would you like us to deviate? And then the pilot of this great big tanker thing then shouts back saying, no, we'll change course. And then it's bizarre seeing these tankers suddenly do like a right turn, then another right turn to get out of your path. And all the time we've got people at Headway UK like tweeting and on Facebook saying this is marvellous, you know, thank you for what you're doing. We raised £2,000 on the event. After I think it was hour number 13, I was back in the water and the pilot said, looking at the charts, we're heading way off course. If you carry on this swim, you might need to swim another 12 hours and the tide will take you past Boulogne, which is way past where you need to be because you need to be near Calais. And there's a certain point on the coast that all the pilots aim for. He said, already, out of the 8 boats that set off this morning, 6 have returned back to base because the tide is beating them. What we also didn't appreciate, and you learn this as you go along, there was a massive low-pressure system that had moved across to the North Sea 3 days before, and that then forces water down the channel, down the French coast, towards Cornwall and the Channel Islands. And you're swimming against this massive current of water all the time. And then it's bizarre to see the coast sort of looking further and further away as you're swimming frantically, thinking, I'm swimming for my life here. And then it got to the point where we looked at the charts and it would have meant we would have had to carry on swimming for at least another 12 hours before we had any chance of the tide turning to push us back up the French coast. And it was with great reluctance that the decision was made by my 3 relay team members on the boat, the support person and me shouting from the water, that halfway through my third hour swim, we called it off because we knew we couldn't get to the coast.
Adrian, it's fantastic to have you on the show. And I just can't imagine, how did you feel after you'd put all that effort in?
It's hard to admit this. Fortunately, the boat was big enough to hide in different places. And I took myself off downstairs to one of the cabins and cried for an hour as the boat was racing back towards Dover. Now, we knew we'd gone a long way out of our way because it then took 3.5 hours of sailing at full speed to get the boat back to Dover. By the time we arrived, we were sort of living in a daze as we got off the boat and took all our things off. We had time to pop to a Chinese takeaway and take it back to the chalet, and we ate that in complete silence. But we got up the following day, dusted ourselves down and said, you know, that was brilliant. When are we going to attack it again? So that's still going to be done, but we're going to have a couple of years off because COVID's got in the way and upset everybody's channel swim progress and blah, blah, blah. So we're going to take it easy and tackle it again in a couple of years' time, maybe.
So you're going to go and have another go at it. And now, knowing what you know through having attempted it once already, are there a number of things that you've sort of got on a checklist that you'll think, well, right, we need to make sure that these are right in order to give us a better chance? Because there's so many things conspiring against you.
There is, John. And now, we've learned about pressure systems and we've learned about tidal systems. We've learned about how the small boats move through the water. We've learned about what we need to do as swimmers to actually improve even further. So there's just so much more, and the practice we could do in the seas. I mean, bizarrely, we did the whole different range of practicing. We took ourselves off in February and March to Filey to swim in violent seas. And fortunately, we discovered, again, through our open water network of lifeguards that sometimes appear at weekends out of season. And that's one of the reasons the draw to Filey. We went swimming out of season and we had 3 fabulous lifeguards one day with a boat shadowing us out in the middle of the North Sea. You know, it's just things you would never imagine that we've learned that we can actually put in practice for our next attempt.
I was as you were talking there and earlier as well then, Adrian, I was drawing some analogies around rules and regulations. So we live in an increasingly complex world. It costs businesses and individuals lots of money, and it costs them lots of time. It seems to me that you must be, hamstrung by rules and regulations, both in your work and also in your charity work.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just wonder what your thoughts are around that, and can we not make things a little bit more simplistic?
Well, I think it's bizarre for me to say because I work in the legal world, but there are too many rules and regulations, John. even this process we're going through to become a charity in our own right from a small Headway branch, we've now had 5 separate hour meetings of a subcommittee to go through the different policies, procedures, rules that you have to put in place when you become a charity, and that we have to have as a branch of Headway UK, that the committee members and the members themselves have to detail. There's social media policies, there's GDPR, there's so many rules and regulations that run the charity on the day-to-day basis, that we as the people who run the charity can't actually get on with to do what we need to do because of all the paperwork involved.
Yeah, I was just thinking, it's funny that, you know, you do work in such an environment that's constrained by rules and regulations, and we do need that from a law point of view, but whether that working in such a kind of rules and regulations based industry and then doing charity work around something as you know, as sensitive as brain injury means that you are drawn a little bit more to riskier activities like swimming the channel and renovating houses and things like that. Have you ever thought about and analysed that yourself?
Yeah, and I'm still analysing it, and I don't know where I'm going, Rachel, with that one.
Every time I speak to you, you've got some other wild thing, but I think maybe you need that balance.
Well, I'll give you another example. Going back in history, many years ago, back to the 1990s, I was an insurance broker working 9 to 5 in a high street branch, living quite a boring life. And I actually saw at the time the Conservatives were in power, and Michael Howard was talking about what a special constable can do for their community. And I sent off for my pack, and this pack arrived from the Home Office. And I think within a week, I'd sent my application off. And by March 1993, or was it 92? Might be 92. 93. No, 93. I then became a special constable in Doncaster.
Oh.
And, you know, I did so many different things I would have not have normally done in my 9-to-5 job. Gone to work, gone home, done whatever, but you finished work at 5 o'clock, and by 6 o'clock, you've got a uniform on and you're patrolling around the streets. Now, what was particularly interesting when I first started, the area in which I worked in Doncaster was right on the edge of the red light district. And one of the first duties I got involved with was with the vice and drug squad of patrolling around the red light district at nighttime. And the laugh became when I got to know most of the prostitutes on a first name basis as part of the job of intelligence and collection and gathering of information, that quite often you sat at the desk in the insurance brokers at 9 a.m. in the morning, and there's Tracy banging on the window who's just finished a job from the night before.
Oh dear, talk about shaking up your life from going from a boring 9-to-5. That was bringing that back to that channel swimming. And, you know, you were saying you went massively off course, but you still found meaning in it. Talk us through the story of your career, because I think you really encompassed this kind of notion of ikigai for me when you and I were doing our coaching together. You very early, and I don't know whether you recognize this in yourself or not, but I certainly recognize this in you, is that you have been almost comfortable in your own limitation within a field of, say, a job, and gone, well, that's okay, that's the job I know. Maybe I'm not where I want to be with that, but I am, you know, really respecting you, is that you kind of think, well, this is my job now, but I'm not going to sit here and go, it's not doing this, this and this for me. I'm going to go and start a charity and do this. I'm going to go and find my passion for this other project and do this at the same time. And when we talk about this notion of ikigai, it's around finding what you love, finding what the world needs, finding what you can be paid for, and finding what you're good at. And a lot of people, I think, stress today that they want one job to do all of that, and they're disappointed in themselves if they don't do all of that. But you really do demonstrate that you can find your passion, your mission, your vocation, and your profession, and you can do them in all different walks of life, and in all, you know, you can have two jobs at the same time. You can have a job and do charity work and do open water swimming, and you've been really, really good at that. And I don't know whether I'm imagining that it's purely by accident that you found this path, but it is a journey that, a bit like your channel swim, you've gone off course a lot on, but you always seem to find your way back to finding this concept of Ikigai, because you always come across as somebody who, if not always very, very happy, but you're accepting of who you are and you've got purpose and meaning in your life.
Yeah, I think it stems back to when I was 15, when my dad died just before my O-levels. And I always wanted to be an accountant. Don't know why. And all that went a bit wonky when you had to see a child psychologist who said, step back a year. And I said, well, no, actually, I've been with the same people since I was age 9. And I don't want to drop back a year. I don't want to come across as looking like a failure, because that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
But then when I did my exams and I came out with 3 O-levels, it was kind of like, why didn't I listen to that person? You know, sometimes it's that, I don't know, even the leadership that you need, because that person's got that experience. But I think at that age, you're so headstrong. You're like, I'm not going to listen to you.
Yeah, I don't think you can beat yourself up for that age.
No. And then I went off to college and started doing, because I have ended up getting quite a few A-levels in the end. And then I went off to college to do 3 A-levels in the hope of going to university as a late starter. And, you know, after the first year, I was like, this isn't for me. You know, it's I've had enough. And I told the college, and then they said, well, what about this? You can do a national diploma in business studies. One of the best things I ever did. I learned to type. Out of 25 people on the course, 2 of us were male, rest female, and part of the course was learning to touch type. That has been an invaluable thing I've learned that's got me through all sorts of different jobs. Even at one point, I was a personal assistant to a regional manager of a health insurance company. So I like to turn my hands to different things, and I think having that practical experience set me off on that course. And then another job, I became a customer helpline administrator for Belling Domestic Appliances, and I loved that job for 6 months. Yeah. It was only temporary, and during that time I won the temp of the year
for
the firm I was working for, because I'd actually developed a whole database system of all the cookers that Belling had produced since 1949 to make it easier for everyone in the helpline to give information to. Best achievement there was helping someone with a baby belling in Zambia who'd had the knobs melted. We managed to get knobs out to Zambia.
I mean, early 90s, though, there was no internet.
So no, that's right.
Yeah. You know, you've got to put it in context. You know, carry on. So after that, what did you do?
I became a recruitment consultant. And I think that must have given me a knowledge of working for solicitors, because we supplied secretarial temps to different legal practices in and around South Yorkshire. And actually, bizarre, at Partners in Cost, one of the big firms we worked for, based in Doncaster, I worked for them previously, supplying them with secretarial temps. So I've known that particular sort of head of department there for donkey's years, even though technically when he worked for him for 8 years. Anyway, yeah. I've just digressed slightly. And then after that job, and whilst it was still a special constable, I'd met the boss of Partners in Costs, who, after much persuasion, said, why don't you come and work for us? I said, well, I don't know anything about costs. And she said, no, but it's a job you can learn on the job and you can just run with it. And as you know me, Rachel, I like a challenge. And then it became a challenge, as in, I want to know more about this job. I want to do this job.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, at the time, we had a couple of test cases that stayed every single thing. And when I say stayed, it meant we couldn't progress them. Everything got stopped by 2 test cases that questioned the validity of conditional fee agreements. And the job became so boring. And in the end, I had to say to my boss, I need to leave. I can't. I'm doing nothing at work and it's driving me crazy.
Yeah.
And one of the clients we worked for, I discovered they were looking for someone to draft their family work. And I actually took that job knowing that it wasn't in conflict with the job I'd just left, and I wasn't taking any work away from the firm I was working for at Partners in Costs. And there I had a brilliant, I don't know, brilliant job, an atmosphere, and the colleagues were amazing to work for. And I did that for 6 or 7 years. And why did the job end? Well, it's because the solicitors practice themselves decided that they didn't want to do family work anymore. So the job disappeared. I got made redundant. And then, you know, lots of people were treating it as tragic news and it was really bad. And I was like, well, what can I go on to do next? And that's when I moved into the area of clinical negligence back in, 2008.
Yeah. And then that's when you've then that was back to PIC and then...
No, I did, I did, I think, four or five firms before I went back to PIC. I did a couple of national costume firms, but I don't know, it was just, we were remote offices and you felt out of it, so I never gelled with those jobs. And then I worked for a couple of family cost drafting firms. And then at the time, legal aid was being forced out and pushed out by the government of the day, funding withdrawn. And I saw the potential of that market drying up. And then I think for a whole year, my boss at Partners in Costs kept coming to me, I wish you'd come back and work for us. You know, we've got so many opportunities. And eventually she ground me down after inviting me to barbecues and parties and meeting staff, going to the Christmas party. And I wasn't even a member of staff going to Christmas party. And eventually I said yes and went back to Partners in Costs. And that was 8 years ago.
Yeah. And I think what's nice about that story, though, is, you know, often people think about a leadership career as being very well thought out and, you know, you need to be driven to do it from day dot. But you've just talked around a career that's kind of, you've just tried your hardest, you've taken on new challenges and you've moved around, but you've always had side projects like your special constable and your headway stuff.
Well, there's another one, Rachel. There's another one.
Go for it.
Back in 2001, I went off to the Netherlands, never been before. I'd always ever loved languages. I loved French at school. I did a bit of Italian, a bit of German. And when I came back from the Netherlands, it was like, I love this language. I want to learn more about it. And fortunately, Doncaster College was running a conversational class, which I did for 2 years. I went off and learnt a bit of how to order a coffee and tea in Dutch. I loved it so much that the course ended because the lesser taught languages were being pulled at the time because of funding, and I rang the Dutch embassy. This is how keen I was to learn Dutch. I rang the Dutch embassy and this woman, like the education officer, was like, really, this Englishman wants to learn Dutch? This is so amazing. And at the time, you could learn Dutch at Leeds Met University, University College London, and there is a specialist Dutch school in Oxford that teaches it up to degree level. And with Leeds being on my doorstep, I plumped to go to Leeds Met University. And I was there for 2 years doing conversational class. And then one day this lady popped around going, would anybody like to do a degree in this particular chosen language? And I was like, well, actually, yes, let's give it a go. So I then started on the path of doing a degree in Dutch language and culture.
Wonderful.
Part-time.
So that's getting your passion in again.
Yes.
So where did you what about your police constable work then? Where else did that take you?
Gosh, it took me to a year working in the road traffic department and coming across horrific accidents to sweeping up glass on a motorway. I assisted with the police cadets. They were 16 to 18 year olds who were looking towards a career in the police and were like the air and army cadets turning up once a week for training. That led me to do so many different things of going away on weekends. And we once went off to an old Second World War army base in Scotland. And that was a proper kind of like, you know, the current Channel 4 thing where they get celebs to do SAS type things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We did that for a week. That was absolutely amazing. I've never conquered my fear of heights, but we abseiled off this high dam. I refused to do it. And when you see 20, 16 to 18 year olds screaming their heads off, hanging off a piece of rope and then actually thoroughly enjoying it, it got right to the end of the day. And I said to this captain, I went, I know I've said no all day, but would you mind if I just closed my eyes and just jumped over, attached the rope naturally? And he said, well, it's getting dark. We really shouldn't be doing it now. I said, no, but and then he could see in my eyes that I really wanted to do it. He went, okay, we'll do it just for you. So I abseiled down this huge, enormous dam that I've never done since, but, you know, I've crossed it off my list. What else did I do? Oh, the community department, being a special constable, you get to go and fit door locks on old people's homes. But it's not just that. It's like that old person might not see anybody for months, and then it takes you an hour to fit a door lock. But that old person has then been so, I don't know, comforted by your presence, and having a uniform on the doorstep and then sitting down having a cup of tea. But But thinking back, a regular constable in those days wouldn't have had the time to do that. Whereas we as volunteers could actually give so much more back. And I know it sounds daft, like, oh, you only fitted a door lock. We didn't. We spent an hour with that old person who, I don't know, just made them smile.
Well, you've changed somebody's day, haven't you? That's the bit. So, you know, you've done all sorts of things now. You are in a leadership role now, and you are in a leadership role with Headway. But what is it that you know, through your varied career, through kind of living this concept of Ikigai, what have you learned about leading yourself?
I think I've learned that I always want to learn more now, no matter what I do. It's just that quest to just develop even further. And I don't know, it's even daft things, Rachel, with your leadership training that you gave me. At one point, I was so disorganized. It was unbelievable. And now I actually...
I'm laughing because she used to come in like a whirlwind.
No, there was always so much going off in my head. And you will be shocked now to learn that... At my bedside table, there's a pad and pen.
I'm not shocked at all, Adrian. Go on, talk us through it. What have you learned?
I brain dump weekly and monthly now. I get things out of my head and put it onto paper. I have to-do lists on my phone that integrate with my work emails and work calendar. And I can tick things off, and it makes me, it makes me happy, the fact that I've actually done those. And then I review kind of even daily, going, right, that hasn't gotten done today. That needs to be a priority for first thing in the morning. And I never used to do that, Rachel. I was just quite scatty, really, of trying to get to the end of everything. But I don't know. It's given me more purpose now to make sure I'm fully organized to do all the things I want to do, because there's so much more I want to do.
Yeah. And what else have you learned on your leadership journey about leading yourself and finding meaning and purpose?
Well, no one's going to ever help you. You've got to do it yourself. And I think it's finding the love of something and then taking it forward. It's even like my love of family genealogy. I suppose I'm organizing people now in terms of my research going back to the 1700s and more likely to the early 1900s, obtaining birth and death certificates, and then sharing it on Facebook groups with distant cousins. Even yesterday, I connected with a new cousin who's three times removed, who only lives in Sheffield. And I've got a regular communication with a cousin in Canada now that's six times removed, that we share the same ancestor from Penistone in Yorkshire from 1700. It's just, but then it's because of my organization, I can manage to keep ticking everything keeps ticking over, as well as managing my day job. That, well, it's, when you say 9 to 5, it's actually 9 to 5, because sometimes I am working later, but it's only because I love what I do.
And what is it about your job why you love it? Is it because you add all these other things around it and that it's led you to discover new things, or what is it about partners in costs or the role you do that you really love what you do?
I think it's all interlinked, Rachel. I think it's because my employers give me the opportunity to go out and do other things with charity work. Because of my inquisitive nature, going around the country, meeting clients for customer service reviews and going to different solicitors' offices, I then also keep an eye out for what's going off locally with local Headway groups and branches, and then I can drop in on them. And it's kind of like a learning curve of sharing information and gathering information of what they're doing that I can take back to Huddersfield and to my own branch as we develop into a group. There's not many jobs out there that would allow me to do that. And that's one of the reasons why I like where I work so much, because I'm given the freedom to go out and do other things whilst attached to work things.
Well, I think you say there's not many jobs out there. There's probably not many leaders out there that allow, you know, your bosses are allowing you and giving you time. Say, as long as the work gets done while you're traveling for work, you can go and live your passion. And that is an incredible gift to be given, a lot of autonomy in your work job, yes, and your average work day.
Yeah, I love it. Absolutely love it.
Talk us through the culture at Partners in Cost that allows you to kind of do your job. That's quite a purposeful job anyway, but also that they are very, they give you a lot of autonomy to do your charity work and to give back. What is it that's special about the culture at Partners in Costs?
Right, Partners in Costs. Just going back to the beginning, they started in 1996 in one room in Doncaster and now employ, I think it's over 70 staff across England and Wales. And one thing that's drawn not just me back, there are other members of staff who've worked at PIC, Partners in Costs, and then gone off elsewhere and then been brought back. And I think one of the reasons for that, and it was International Women's Day on the 8th of March, and I was looking at the figures, and I think it's 62% of one part of the company is female, and another wing of the company that deals with non-contentious costs and local government work, 73% of the staff are women. Amazing. And I think that's, it is absolutely amazing. And I'll give you the reason why is because Teresa, the big boss, I think had this vision of, she looked at her own life when she set the firm up and looked at the problems of raising a family whilst being a busy leader herself and running that organization. And she's still got that as part of the day-to-day ethos to this very day. If somebody, circumstances change dramatically overnight, I don't know, it might be somebody gets divorced all of a sudden or like leaves the partner or a family member dies, straight away there's this culture there of caring for that member of staff, and people jump into action. Different managers and the HR manager jump into action and respond. And somebody might say, you know, I've come back off maternity, there's no way I can work 5 days a week anymore. It's just not an issue. It's like that person might have been stressing out going, oh, how do I tell them this? But then they'll say, well, what do you want to work? 2 days, 3 days? Do you want to just work mornings? Or in fact, there's some staff members who, again, love the job so much that they might start work at 7 a.m. and work till 9, till they drop the kids off at school, then work again, stop work at 2 o'clock, but then once the kids have gone to bed at 7, so it's very, the flexible working is a big draw to many people. And I think that's why we have such a large young female staff that have young children, is because of the ability to do that flexible working. And like myself, given the autonomy to go off and get involved in a charity, and then encourage other people at work to get involved in the charity. I think they've got 6 staff now involved in different headways across the UK. And I've never worked for a place that allows you to do and develop yourself in roles that are outside work. It's just a fab place to work.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think that's really useful. I was, it's funny you mentioned that International Women's Day and Teresa, because, you know, when people talk about the flexible working, particularly with women, we think about a lot of companies that have done this over the last year. But I remember Teresa's quite well known in the Doncaster area. She was doing this in the 90s.
She was, yeah. Absolutely.
And 2000s. And I remember her featuring in the Sunday Times article. She was one of the first women in the UK to implement a policy of totally flexible working for women.
Yes.
Way beyond any notion of there even being internet everywhere. So it's really wonderful to hear that that culture's really survived and that it feels like a family.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Yeah. Good. When you speak to Teresa, it's like she just wants everyone to. Well, do you know, one of the things that she always says is you learn from your mistakes, and she supports anybody that makes a mistake. And gosh, there hasn't been many, but sometimes there's been catastrophic mistakes on a case. And she went, so what have you learned from this? And when the person shares with what they've learned, they went, that's fine. You won't do it again, will you? And it's just a different approach. It's like I've worked for people in the past who would go absolutely ballistic if a particular deadline was missed. But if somebody says, you know, I missed it for a particular reason and this is why, and I'm struggling because of this, then it's always looked into. So I just think that's the added bonus of working for the person that we work for.
Adrian, you have so much variety, so much novelty in everything that you do. And so just as well that you're really, really organized. I'm just wondering, what advice would you give to any of our listeners around going to get new jobs nowadays, most people are always asking for experience. And so how do you get to do so many things when you don't have sort of the experience to do them? Is it just the enthusiasm? Because lots of people really like novelty and often can't stick with the same thing for very long. And so I just wondered what your take was on that.
Gosh, I think the ability to, I don't know, to retrain, but without spending time retraining. So I think one of the ways, if you're stuck in a dead-end job or you're stuck in a job that you don't really enjoy and there's not much chance of moving within that particular area, I think you've got to go and volunteer and do something that's completely different. And why do I say that? It's because different job interviews in my past, when I've talked about the work I do, whether it be charity work or volunteering, it's something you do in that volunteering job, you can actually use and mold to take forward to that new job that you want or you've got a passion for. Or it might be that you go back off to school part-time and do something. You know, in this social media age, people are crying out for people with the experience of using Twitter and LinkedIn. Well, how do you get that experience if you don't do any day-to-day job? Well, I think then you've got to go off and find a course to do it, or find a forum, or there's even online, especially with COVID now, there's even online forums you can join just to build up your experience. There's lots of different things you can do, John.
So you think it's like, it's a tandem thing then, really, that you've got to be able to put the effort in, to go and find how you do something rather than just simply switching from one role or one kind of a job to another. And also what helps with that is this volunteering in something that particularly gets your interest.
Yes, definitely. I mean, it doesn't have to be anything that that would lead you into. You don't have to know anything about it, because you can learn from the bottom, and it becomes a learning curve, and it becomes more of a challenge to find out even more once you start on that learning curve.
Yeah.
Well, for example, open water swimming. I started it and I wasn't very good at it because I couldn't even swim at school to save my life. But finding that passion and then speaking to other open water swimmers saying, I want to learn more, who can teach me? And then found this amazing channel swimmer in Bradford running a small group of swimmers. There's always somebody somewhere, John. And something else, from the Olympics in 2012, I did an online questionnaire about what sport suits you the best. And this is still on my to-do list. It says the perfect sport for me is fencing. Who'd have thought that I could be a fencer? I'm not talking about wood in the garden. I'm talking about, you know, the metal blade thing.
Are you going to? You will, won't you? You will definitely be doing fencing at some point in your life.
Well, funnily enough, I actually started making inquiries when COVID hit.
Right. So it's just on the burner at the moment. Back burner.
It's on hold until we're released from lockdown.
How long do you give it before you decide that you need to move on? Because you've packed so many things in to your life so far, you know, how do you make that decision?
I don't know. I think it's one. I think you start to love it from the start. Because again, with the open water swimming, in order to go on the swim, on a relay swim, you have to swim in open water for 2 hours at round about 13 degrees Celsius. Well, the only way we could get our qualifying swim in for the swim in June 2018 was to go to Ibiza in April, because the sea temperature there was 12 to 13 degrees. And we took our swimming coach with us, and four of us went off and swam for 2 hours in Ibiza. And again, that's something like that then gave us a love of this place in Ibiza. So much so, the year afterwards, we went and did, some of us did Ibiza 12K and some did the Ibiza Marathon from this swimming group I'm involved with. And then we were all going when COVID hit this time last year, because the ability to swim there, to train, and now a new passion of running, it all fits together. And it's just, you know, John, as soon as you start doing it, and it's also with the group of people that you're with as well, that you can feed off.
Yes.
And I feed off these people. And I think that's another thing about when we're talking about leadership. I have to feed off other people to do what I need to do.
So the social aspect for you is very alluring, and it supports your interest levels.
Yes. Yeah.
I think just to add to that, though, I think you've touched on something really important there, Adrian, in that, you know, obviously you like being led by people like that, and you like a group to lead you and motivate you.
Yes.
But I know firsthand you are very inspiring to be around. So, you know, you've got all this passion, you've got all these interests, you are a very positive person. And as a leader, to share these interests with people that are working for you is a great gift to give as well. And you do give people a sense and a feeling of energy because you're so curious about things and you're so willing to give anything a try.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes my downfall is when we have meetings with Headway Huddersfield and there might be something controversial or we've sorted something out, it's the messages I get after the event that go, oh, you know, that warms my heart, as in, oh, thank you, that's amazing, and blah, blah, blah. And I don't really shout about that. And I don't know why, but I like the nice little feedback, but that's just for me. That's what I get out of it.
That's demonstrating humility. I think what John was chatting around what it is that makes you different for this. I think your journey and your experience and your story has really shared with our listeners that mindset really does matter, and that increasingly people hire for an attitude rather than necessarily experience or qualifications. And I think, you know, if you're curious and willing to give something a go and you show that you're constantly learning, that is a great attitude to hire for.
Yeah.
And you know, we've had a fair few people on this podcast who have been associated with charities, but it really does seem something that, you know, again, back to the concept of ikigai, and there's been so much research on this from a psychology point of view, that people that do volunteer are generally happier, have better well-being, tend to try harder in their roles. But I really liked that piece of advice that you said, that, you know, if you're in a job that's not necessarily giving you a sense of achievement, ask yourself, is there a way you could volunteer to kind of live your passion or to give something back? Because you'll feel good for it, and then it'll be something that you could use to get another role.
Absolutely, spot on there.
Yeah. So while we before we finish up, is there any other stories you want to share? Anything else you want to talk about? Any other words of wisdom?
Not words of wisdom, but gosh, I think, you know, one of the first duties I ever did as a special constable was trying to stop a Great Dane dog from being run over on a busy A road in Doncaster. And at the end of the shift, I had to go report that my brand new pair of handcuffs had been lost whilst chasing this Great Dane around the racecourse area of Doncaster. And that became a learning curve in itself about paperwork and rules and regulations. So
how on earth did you lose those?
Because I was chasing over people's gardens and fences through hedges. And at some point, the clasp had become undone in the handcuff holder and they were lost. But I didn't realise what a sort of a major capital offence it was to South Yorkshire Police when you lose a pair of handcuffs, and the paperwork involved, and having to go out with a searchlight to go and look through bushes and trees, etc., that you'd run through chasing after a Great Dane.
Back to the rules and regulations, by the sounds of it.
So funny. So with all of our guests, Adrian, we ask people to share their three leadership essentials. What would be your three leadership essentials for leading yourself and finding more meaning and purpose in life that you would share with our listeners?
Number one is definitely brain dump. You've got to get things out of your head on paper or on a keyboard, because whilst it's still whizzing around your head, you can't think clearly. That's number one.
Yeah.
Number two, do something daring, do something different, do something that you've never done before. Even if you've got a miserable neighbour next door who you hate, just one morning, just say, hi, aren't you fabulous today? You know, just Even at work, if there's somebody you can't really stand, just smile. Make them a coffee. Yeah. Just do something different. Do something daring. And number three is, I don't know, is to... One, I think the final thing is, one thing I have learned is sometimes I learn niche bits of information and don't share it often enough. And then one thing you can do with your colleagues at work is that particular strange thing that might make your job better or deliver better customer service is share amongst the team members with your colleagues. For example, I learnt a very bizarre piece of rules and regulations from the legal aid agency on presenting costs at the end of a case. And people kept coming to me going, you know about this, Adrian, can you just do it? Can you just do it? Can you just do it? And I'm a busy person. And I was spending far too much time doing this work that wasn't really part of my core job. And the thing I got the benefit was I spent 6 hours one day preparing a presentation. I presented it to everybody at work. Now everybody can do that same piece of work. So 6 hours of investment of time has now meant I've got more time to do other things because I'm not doing this niggly job now and again.
That is a really gold piece of advice, that, and that initial investment of 6 hours seems like such a lot of time, but over a year, how much time has that saved you?
That's going to save me so much time, Rachel, and I'm so glad that I did it.
No, that's incredible.
I can't believe how much you get into a day, Adrian. I really can't.
No, and I'm sat here thinking, oh, bugger, I've got all this to do. And I'm like, but hey, oh, I've had a fabulous chat this morning. And I could actually chat all day, but it's not possible.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for sharing your story.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Adrian.
If you found this conversation useful, please do share it with somebody you think will enjoy listening to it too. And if the concept of Ikigai is something that interests you, please do check out our website, scaffoldcoaching.com. On there, we've got a free download that you can just go on, type in your email address, and get access to a free worksheet that helps you work through and discover your Ikigai.
Thank you for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you found today's leadership essentials and coaching discussion points useful. If you'd like to read more about the approach we take, check out our website at scaffoldcoaching.com.